You are listening to the Cork and Taylor Wine Podcast. Each week, we uncork the lighter side of wine with some of the most intriguing people in the wine industry. So grab a glass, let's drink some wine, and talk some shit. Hello, Cork and Taylor wine lovers. Luke Taylor here on a great episode with a man who is a pitcher 4 years in the major leagues with the Boston Red Sox. Same guy or no?
Not quite.
Ah, crap. I guess I'll have to settle for this Mike Trujillo. I got Mike Trujillo of Trujillo Wines and also formerly of Sequoia Grove with me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be with you. Mike, welcome to the, you should say welcome to me because I'm in your place, but welcome to the Cork and Taylor podcast.
Hey, good to be here. And we welcome you here at Trujillo Wine.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So you never played baseball?
Not professionally, no.
Okay.
Because you're no relation to Mike Trujillo.
You know, but the funny thing is, he's from Denver, Colorado. Did you know that?
I do know that.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm a little bit more related to the guy from the Dominican Republic.
Which one's that one?
I'm
thinking about that. You're trying to trick me. I think we should just end right now. Thanks for listening.
Cater of the Dominican Republic. Everybody asked me about that.
Oh, my God. You know, it's funny because your name sounds like the starting second baseman of the San Diego Padres. You just got that professional baseball, you know,
ring around me. And you know, there's a rock star guy named Trujillo too. And
no relation. You know what I used to tell people? I was related to Lawrence Taylor. My dad's side, my mother's side. Yeah. So take me back. So you're originally from a family farm in Colorado. So you have a farming background.
Yes. I grew up in Southern Colorado. Closest town on the map is Alamosa, which is just about 20 miles north of the southern border. And my dad farmed and ranched about 3,000 acres.
Wow. And then you were studying engineering.
After high school, my mom was very adamant to get us into, you know, some education after high school. And you obviously
listened to her, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I'm the oldest of four.
Lord.
But, you know, I love building. So yep. Engineering was sort of a...
What type of engineering?
You know, my dream was to be involved in building bridges, skyscrapers, yep. That kind of stuff, architectural engineering. Yep.
Cool. So
that's where I was headed.
Yeah. And obviously, it didn't end there.
I came close. I was on my third year, just got this crazy notion to head west. A group of guys, we jumped in a car and headed west, ended up in LA, and that didn't really fit our lifestyle, mm-hmm. and headed north and ended up in Napa Valley to visit a friend of the family and never made it back.
Was the friend of the family, I believe, father owned a vineyard, correct?
That's right. Ironically, as you mentioned in my introduction, we pulled in to Sequoia Grove Winery. The family member or the family acquaintance was a gentleman named Jim Allen, who used to actually live in Santa Fe,
okay.
and knew my family and friends. And so we were just pulled in to stop the visit, never had met him before, he'd never met us. And this sort of cold call landed, bunch of farm kids jumped out and worked where we could, and he fed us and drank as well.
So. Yeah. And that must have been a really neat time in the valley. There's probably a lot, like 1/10 of the wineries they have now, probably even less than that.
Yeah. And it was very, you know, in that era, in that early 80s time, it was just sort of almost cowboyish frontier. Everybody was getting along. Everybody was helping everybody. It was a really great time.
Yeah. So you landed, I guess you helped plant Sequoia Grove, correct?
It was kind of one of the first jobs. You know, Jim's brother, Steve Allen, was the vineyardist. It's what we did to earn a few bucks to make a living. It was our first job. And then from there, I went on to work for what is now Domaine Carneros, those vineyards.
Okay.
But yeah, the first few years of my career were mainly in the vineyards.
Yeah. And then when did you start at Sequoia Grove?
Well, through my first and early year out in the vineyard, you're meeting some of the great winemakers of Napa. You know, back then it was, you know, the Shavers, the Cake Red, you could just go on and on. Mm-hmm. Some of those early wineries, they were actually buying grapes from the vineyards that I used to work with.
Wow.
One of the key gentlemen that I got to know really well was a gentleman named Andre Chelichev.
Who's that?
Andre Chelichev.
I've been here for 3-4 days. I've never heard that name before.
Oh, come on.
A legend.
He's a legend. Yeah. And you know what? He's helped a lot of great winemakers become who they are, including myself.
Yeah.
So from the vineyard, I was mingling with those folks and being friends with Jim. I was meeting winemakers from around the world. Mm-hmm. Just like all of us, you get the wine bug and you just... all of a sudden, you can't get enough wine.
Yeah.
So from there, I was influenced and nudged along to learn the science of winemaking. Mm-hmm. and I did go to school at UC Davis. I had to make a living at the same time, so I had to go through the extension program and go to school in the at night.
Right.
But when I got out of school in 1990, I was then wanting to be a winemaker, and that's where I approached Jim Allen to see if I could work for him at Sequoia Grove, and I started there as assistant winemaker, you might say, under his tutelage.
Yep.
Andre was a consulting winemaker.
Oh, really?
I drove that.
Okay,
so that
wow.
was a win-win. And so through the 90s, I worked, my day job was working with Sequoia Grove. But I also launched a label right out of school. I launched a label called Carl Lawrence, which was, Carl is my middle name. And Lawrence was one of many investors I solicited, and the only one that came up with a little bit of money to help me get started.
So he kind of, like, when you buy an arena, he bought the name, right? Kind of?
Well,
to a certain extent.
He was the only one crazy enough to give me a check.
So then that would be a yes. Yes. Just answer the damn question. Yes. Oh, my Lord. And you kind of went all the way up through, I mean, Sequoia Grove, right?
I worked the ranks as Jim's family and kids sort of peeled away, and it opened up more doors for me. And I grew up with the work ethic, you know, with my dad. So I was always hardworking. And the more experience I gathered just in winemaking, I just sort of worked my way up the ladder. Became, you know, associate winemaker and so on and so forth. The whole time I was doing my own project, Carl Lawrence, and I was actually making it at Sequoia.
Wow.
And lo and behold, when Jim announced his retirement, Jim Allen, I was really didn't see Sequoia Grove in my sights for my career.
Okay.
I had opportunity for consulting. I was already making a handful of wines for other people, big names, big famous Cabernets, you know, Herb Lamb, stuff like that. And through some meetings with the family and the new owners of Sequoia Grove, I became the president, director, and CEO.
It's funny how you didn't see your vision, but yet you got a promotion.
You know, I did it because the family was willing to back me 100% to take Sequoia Grove to the next level.
That's awesome. I mean,
both in time, money.
How much were they producing back then before you?
It was probably about 50,000.
Oh, that big even back then?
Yeah,
wow.
Okay. I shrunk it down a little bit to sort of get it rebooted. The family was super supportive and, you know, plenty of money to revamp and re-equip and modernize the facility. You know, and reposition for grapes and better grapes. So, you know, I was at the helm at Sequoia Grove. I just stepped down a couple of years ago. I stepped away as CEO and head of winemaking, and now I just want to focus in on what I love doing best. It's making wine and helping people make wine.
Yeah. So you launched your wine. Well, I mean, you've launched other wine labels, but this wine label, right, that we're about to drink here, how long ago? What was the first vintage?
So my first vintage of Trujillo was 2011.
Okay. What a great vintage, huh? According to the press.
Oh, my Lord. I love challenging vintages. I mean, if you look at my track record, I shine on the pivotal.
I feel, you know, it's, I feel like the 11 was actually one of my favorite vintages.
Yeah.
You know, the press just beat the crap out of it. And it was really unfortunate. But I'm telling you, I've got some 11s in my cellar, and they're still drinking great.
Yeah. And a decade before that, it was 08. You know, and
You always love the wine critics, huh?
But who?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, listen, they've got their place, and, you know, some people have their varying opinions on it. But so what do we got first? Let's try something.
Well, as I broke away and I started the Trujillo brand, you know, I'm all about Cabernet. I produce Cabernet and red wine. And now that I have, you know, a tasting room and a facility, and I host winemaker dinners and a wine club. You know, it's kind of hard to bank 100% on Cabernet. You know, it sort of thins your audience a little bit. And it's very, very tough to do a winemaker dinner with Cabernet and Cabernet and Cabernet and Cabernet. So I introduced.
You can. But it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely a carnivore type.
Yeah. Oh, come on.
So I launched a secondary, a companion label that I call Madeline, and it's named after my daughter, Sophia Madeline Trujillo.
Okay.
Obviously, for obvious reasons, I don't use Sophia, because there's a fellow wine vintner here in Napa that
Gotta love the lawyers, huh?
No, you had the name first. Yeah. But, you know, Madeline's a beautiful name. Yeah. And
Only child?
Only child.
Yeah.
She's actually very involved in helping me out.
And, how old is she now?
She's about to turn 16.
Okay.
And that's a good fella.
Yeah.
So under the Madeline line, I make really fun sort of whimsical wines. I have a white blend combination of Sauv Blanc and Gewurztraminer. Demeanor.
Awesome.
Dry, crisp, clean. I do a rosé. This vintage, I made it with mainly Sangiovese, but I had some Grenache in there as well.
Okay.
I have a red blend, which is taking a red wine out of the Cabernet category, mm-hmm. making a soft, sexy, silky red wine. Mm-hmm. And then I have a Cabernet under the Madeline label. Those are all more affordable, less, you know, they're by no means are they lesser quality. They're
right.
just meant to be more casual, more mm-hmm. And then from there, you step up to the Trujillo main label, mm-hmm. and that's all about Cabernet. And then on very good vintages, I might make a Reserve.
Okay.
But let me pour you some of the white.
Okay.
So again, this is a wine that we have to help me just diversify with our club and diversify mm-hmm. with winemaker names and stuff. Very, very unique blend. I think I'm one of the very few that actually blend these two varietals together. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's almost a 50-50 blend, Sauv Blanc and Gewurztraminer.
Why?
You know, I just discovered this combination, and there's just something about those two varietals that actually complement each other. The Gewurztraminer gives you all those bright aromatics, that mango, tropical,
right,
up in the nose. When you go to smell, you think that this wine is going to be kind of clunky and a little bit heavy. Mm-hmm. And then you blend it in with that Sauv Blanc.
It's really
that
pretty.
Grapefruit and crispness. Mm-hmm. This is a super refreshing white wine.
Why not Chardonnay?
I do make Chardonnay yep. for my clients, and I yep. will introduce a Chardonnay. Yep.
Because everybody, I feel like when you're in Napa, you have to have a Chardonnay.
Yes and no, but
to a certain extent.
My favorite white wine is white Burgundy. I love a great white Burgundy. And it's my style of white wine. Mm-hmm. The wines that I made at Sequoia Grove were of that direction. Mm-hmm. I have one in the works. I will be bottling on a 2019 Chardonnay under the Trio label.
And then how many cases do you make of each wine?
Very small. Collectively, with all my labels, I'm still about 2,500 cases.
Okay, nice.
Madeline's all fall in about the 200-300 case range mm-hmm. for each varietal. The Trujillo main cab is about 500 plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do a handful of reserves. When I say handful, a barrel or maybe yeah. two barrels of each.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah, that's really pretty.
Yeah, it's fun. And if you look at the label, it's the back pocket of a pair of jeans, denim jeans. So when you're wearing
way to recycle them.
That and
I should give you some of my jeans. I mean, I'm a, like a size 38 waist. I mean,
That could go on a Magnum or something like that.
I was thinking like maybe like a Jeroboam or whatever the hell it is, a 6 liter, 25 liter. That's awesome. Why the denim jeans?
It's casual.
Yeah,
the messaging is casual.
That's fun. Yeah, when you, especially if you name it after your daughter who's a teenager. Yeah. I mean, they wear jeans, right? They wear denim.
What's left of the jeans, you might say.
It's your problem, not mine. I got a 10-year-old, and I don't think she's going to be wearing those types of jeans.
No, I'm not talking. They're a full label. They're, they're ripped and torn and worn out.
Yeah, my wife would buy these jeans. They're like, how much were they? Like $200. And I'm like, well, don't you get a discount? There's like nothing on them. She goes, honey, this is the look. I'm like, what?
They're worn out.
Oh, my God. Ridiculous.
No.
That's really pretty. So what, how long did, with Mr. Chelichoff, how long was he kind of consulting with Sequoia Grove?
Him, Andre and Jim Allen had a great relationship, and Andre was always involved in the Sequoia Grove production. I would say from 85 to up in time that Andre passed in 93. So.
You probably have some great stories.
Oh, my Lord, I do.
Give me a story that you can't talk about.
Well,
you like how I premise that one.
Well, for me, just going to school and doing your homework with Andre was a bonus, because Andre he taught you how to make wine from your heart and your soul, mm-hmm. the art of wine. You know, mm-hmm. school teaches you science, but like anything in life, trade and experience gets passed down to you. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a craftsman or a chef or mm-hmm. mechanic or whatever you may mm-hmm. be, you learn from the people that have been ahead of you. And that's what Andre had, mm-hmm. that wisdom and the magic to help you feel wine.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the best advice he ever gave you? One thing. Best thing, it just sticks with you on a daily basis.
Just believe in what you taste.
Yeah.
Believe in what you feel and what you taste. I mean, and even today, as I look back and you see how wine trends all over the place, mm-hmm. style, and I know I've been making my wine the same way my whole career. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I'm just getting hopefully better at it.
Yeah.
You know, but my style does not chase trend or press or mm-hmm. points or critics mm-hmm. at all. And
do you have UPC codes on the back of your wines?
I do not.
Ah, see, that's a trick, right? So you're not going to sell them to grocery stores.
Well, if you do, they have to put the UPC code on themselves.
Yeah.
And my productions are so small. Yeah. And in the world of technology, that's someday going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny how it's not kind of even the boutique-y wine shops and what have you. They're like, just give it to me. I'll put a price sticker on it. Yeah. Or I'll put this, whatever. Yeah, real nice. All right, let's try red here.
Let's do it.
Go for a red.
Okay, so I mentioned the Madeline Red Cuvée. This is a wine that I purposely drive the Cabernet percentage downward.
Oh, really?
In order to be varietal, you have to be 75% or yep. better. So here we're talking 55-60% Cabernet Sauvignon, all from great vineyards that I source from, mm-hmm. Rutherford, Howe Mountain, St. Helena. But I purposely drive in more Merlot, more Franc, bring those aromatics up with the Franc and cool. the raspberry up with the Merlot, and then just sort of soak it out a little bit.
Yeah, that is, you can just on the nose, you can just smell it's going to be a smooth wine.
It gets all the same treatment. It's all French oak aged, 22 months. Mm-hmm. By no means is any of this wine purchased on the bulk market or purchased elsewhere. It's all stuff I've made.
Not this week, right?
Well, you know what? Ever. There's some deals to be had.
Oh, but, God, yeah. 2018. Open up your pocketbook.
I prefer to make sure I have my hand on the wine.
Do you think a lot of the way kind of Napa's going, or Sonoma's going, more Napa because you're quintessential Napa, do you think it's still going like that where there's you're buying stuff that you know what you're getting kind of? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, do you think the winemakers and the wine owners are having the control to, or do you think it's just kind of all across the board, kind of the styles and?
Well, they're definitely throughout the whole wine business over the last 4 or 5 decades, there's always one or two trends that latch on. I mean, in the 80s, we had oaky buttery chart.
Right.
You know, there's always some sort of trend that latches on. And you get the percentage of the producers that chase that trend. Mm-hmm. So you always have that. Mm-hmm. What I see coming down is maybe the baby boomer era, the mm-hmm. collectors, the people just love having those big trophy wines, those high point mm-hmm. wines, the bragging right wines. Yep. I kind of see that going away.
Yep.
I think the up and coming is going to be value. Consistency, mm-hmm. the story is going to mean a lot to the new younger buyers. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the story, mm-hmm. the
connection, relationship,
connection,
yep.
and value.
Yep.
And you need to deliver, at whatever price you're asking for, you need to deliver.
What are these price points like?
So the Madeline White and Rosé is 24 a bottle. The okay. Madeline Red Cuvée 50. The Cabernet is 55.
Not bad.
And then the Trujillo will go to 84. The main cab and the reserves will tip 135.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
That's not bad whatsoever. That's really nice.
Yeah, I like this wine. This is actually the minute it
very pleasant, itself, very smooth.
It sells out very quickly.
What, do you change the blend each year? Or?
It alters a little bit. Mm-hmm. When I'm making it, I'm striving for that real silky balance. Mm-hmm. thing. I mean, and it's kind of whatever I have that spills away from the main Trio blend. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's a little bit different every year.
Yeah, real pretty. So you left Sequoia Grove. Are you still doing some consulting?
I do. I have a couple projects. I'm heavily and greatly involved with the Matera winery.
Never heard of that winery.
What?
No, I know. I interviewed Chelsea earlier today.
Isn't she was amazing?
And she spoke very highly of you. And she's very for where she's come from.
Yeah.
You know, like her parents and even more so her mom's dad or grandfather. You'd never think so. And she's probably really, it's probably cool to see her in her kind of, not start, but I mean, she's in her early 30s to kind of see her evolution. And, it sounds like she can really handle advice and which, in this day and age with the younger generation, they kind of know it all per se. And she just does not come across like that.
And you know what I like about Chelsea is I like her style of wine.
Yeah.
Is, you know, we are all talking about styles and trends and all of that stuff. She, you know, with her pedigree and what her dad makes and her mom makes, it's great wine. It's great balanced wine. And you're going to get that from Matera. You already see great things happening at Matera. Mm-hmm. It'll take us.
Oh, yeah. And it's a beautiful facility. First time ever been there. It's like, okay.
That was one of my projects.
Really?
Yeah. I was very heavily involved in the design.
Yeah.
The
building. It's gorgeous. I mean, you know, and the Kunats don't spare. I mean, they're salt of the earth people. I've met Brian. I haven't met his wife. I've met Brian a couple times and very unassuming and unpretentious. But then you see the attention to detail. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
But it's not gaudy. It's not like, look at me kind of thing. It's very, it fits in. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, when I met Brian when he first came out to Napa Valley in 07, and he asked for me to advise and help him. Mm-hmm. When we went to go build that winery, it was just amazing how he was dedicated to the quality first. You know, let's make a fantastic kitchen and then we'll build the rest of the house later. Mm-hmm. And it was a fun project developing and building that winery. So, yeah.
And it's kind of funny because you have your hand still in it. And then you have Chelsea Barrett. Yeah. And then you have his son-in-law, Harrison Heights. I mean, if you've never had Napa, if you've ever been to Napa, you know Heights and you know Barrett. So that's got to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a great. And you know, what's another crazy ironic little part of that story is my tanner at Sequoia Grove. I hired a gentleman when I first became assistant winemaker. We're talking early 90s. I hired a gentleman, Luis, who today now runs the operation. He's the cellar foreman and runs all of the production out. Applications at Sequoia. Luis's son, Luis Jr., plays the exact same role at Matera.
Isn't that crazy? But isn't in life and even most more so in the winery, even though it's grown exponentially in Napa, it's really who you know. And it's all about relationships.
Absolutely.
Right? And if you've had a good experience with the father, you hope the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And, you know, more times than not, it doesn't. And it's a trust thing, right? Because, I mean, you are the maestro as a winemaker, the conductor. And you have everybody kind of, you know, the cellar master, the vineyard manager, the owner, if you're not the owner. And you're trying to make this perfect symphony. And you got to trust. You got to trust the oboe player, right?
Absolutely. And you have to treat people like people.
Yeah.
I mean, that. Absolutely. I'm very proud that I do that. And I know Brian Kunat and family takes care of people. Mm-hmm. So another project I have is, this is a kind of a new project. It's a family, four generation family here in Napa that has been grape growers, you know, for decades, supplying the great wineries of, you know, Stag's Leap, Ballmeyer. And they're going to dabble a little bit with some wine.
Really?
They've asked me to come on board.
They had to wait 130 years to do it, huh?
Well, the fourth generation. Yeah. So that's a great project. It's called Patuello. That's the name of the family.
Patuello. Okay.
So they have some acreage just north of St. Helena. And
what do they grow there, Cab?
Mainly Cabernet. Yeah. They are tasking me to make them wines out of Gamay, Napa Gamay.
Oh, God.
Oh, my. I'm having
a blast. Oh, God.
I am having a
blast. You know who tried to, I don't know if you know the Ken Laird story. He wanted to buy this vineyard site. I think it was up in Calistoga. It was like a 47-acre prune orchard. And he called the phone book, and Robert Mondavi picked up the phone. And Robert said, if you plant 50% Gamay, I promise you'll have the best Napa Valley Cabernet. Gamay. I think Gamay lost his luster in like 69.
Absolutely. But you know what? It's coming down.
Oh, God, here we go.
We're all making different and exotic, crazy wines.
Yeah, why not?
So I'm making a rosé out of
Gamay. How's that?
Wonderful. Love it.
Really?
And then I'm making them a red wine. And then Cabernet, obviously, because they grow a lot of Cabernet. And
should make a Cabernet Gamay blend. Not probably would fly. Yeah.
Because when you start off in the fermentation process, you are literally going two different directions.
Yeah.
So, you know, Cab, you wanted to be.
I thought you were a good winemaker, though. I mean, you can do it, right?
That's the reason for doing two directions.
No, for sure, for sure. Is there any time where you're just like, man, it'd be kind of fun to blend this and that together and just see what happens?
Well, look at this Madeline White.
Oh, that's Lord.
Exactly what
that's true. Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Yes, yeah.
So, as winemakers, we're always tinkering.
Yeah.
When I was making the Madeline, the 2016 Madeline Cabernet, I just kept telling myself, oh my God, it tastes, it's just a junior league of Trujillo. Mm-hmm. And the customers are going to have a difficult time, mm-hmm. or they're going to be able to recognize that. How do I change it up? So I played with all the varietals. And I found that a little dab of Petit Sirah in that Cabernet just spices it and peppers it up and makes it quite different than the main blend. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're always dabbling.
Do you think it's changed when you first started to now where it's a lot more competitive, per se? I mean, there's a lot less margin of error because of just the cost of everything now in Napa. Do you see that you have to look at, okay, I would really like to make this wine, but can I sell it? A winery I know very well, he once said to me, it's easy to make good wine. It's tough to sell it.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's probably some back then, was it like that too, to a certain extent, or not really?
Back then, I think if you were making a great wine and there was this, and the customers latched onto it, that was the up and coming when we used to have the wine boards and, the internet was becoming a platform for marketing. And, they sort of became, I have the wine you don't scenarios, trophy wines, or I have it, you don't, you can't get it, especially small producers like Carl Lawrence.
Right.
We still have a little bit of that, but not like the old days. This is a little bit different. We are, I think today we're more in just keeping people's cellars in rotation more than we are in collecting. I don't think collecting is as big of a deal as it was 20 years
ago. Right. Isn't there a percentage like 85% of the wines drank and by the time it's purchased, it's like 15 minutes right after?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly.
As winemaker, that makes us trend a little bit to the wines being a little bit more approachable, a little bit more fun, experimental. But yeah, I'm going to be bottling up this year for fun for the wine club, straight Merlot, straight Cab Franc, straight Malbec, just for fun.
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. How many cases?
Like a couple of barrels of each.
Yeah, 50. So 50 cases. Yeah. And you have a big enough wine club, obviously, to just blow through that.
Yeah, and just diversity and great wines
and
great...
And that's a nice thing. If you've got a nice, stable wine club, you can tinker with stuff.
Right.
And if people like... The problem is, if you don't want to make it the next year and everybody loves it, but, I don't know how much that happens, right? To a certain extent.
My success with Carl Lawrence... And even with Sequoia Grove, and you talked about relationships. If your customers can rely and count on you year after year after year, it's a slam dunk. You introduce a new wine, they'll try it.
Right.
It's when you start making crappy wine or too expensive wine or too off the wall.
Hence why I don't make wine.
Yes.
Yes. It'd be in a box. It wouldn't be in a wine box either.
Yeah, so...
Yeah,
I got 40 years under my belt. I've made a lot of mistakes.
Well, yeah, but you learn, and you probably know what you do well and what your customers like and appreciate. I mean, it's let's try the next one if we can.
I am Cabernet is what I'm known for. Like when I was making the Herb Lamb wine, that was a very well known for Cabernet Sauvignon off the Herb Vineyard. So. This, my entire career has sort of been assembling mountain fruit with valley floor. Carl Lawrence, the early vintage of the Carl Lawrence was Rutherford and Hama.
Really?
Yeah. I love that combo. I love what Eaton JVA brings to the wine. The Trujillo is pretty much the same exact vineyards that I used to make the Carl Lawrence out of.
Okay.
Part of my negotiations and the separation from that brand is I got to maintain the vineyard sourcing that I had established. So one of my most long-term, greatest relationship vineyard owners I have is Gary Morazzoli in Rutherford. True Rutherford Bench.
Yep.
It's just in the southern shadows of the Nibam Coppola Ranch. If I was to hit the Powerball tomorrow and I had the choice to buy one vineyard, and believe me, it would take the Powerball to do it.
It would be this
vineyard to get.
Really?
So it's the greatest site, I think, in Napa Valley for Cabernet Sauvignon. And, that's where Andre used to source for BV Latour and, Belta's in there.
Do squatting rights still matter? Like if you slept there for a couple nights on the ground?
They probably shoot you.
I'll do it for you. I mean,
it might take you about 15 years.
Really? But, are you guys that rigid in California up here? We won't go there. That's another part. That's like a 10-part series.
The price of land here is crazy.
Oh, and it just keeps going. It's amazing.
So my wines are, this wine is based, the majority of the blend is Rutherford, Gary Marzoli, Kevin Sauvignon. I've been making wine from that vineyard for 30 years. Love it, love it, love it. I was sourcing from the Herb Lamb vineyard under Carl Lawrence. I now source from a different vineyard that's just above the Herb Lamb vineyard called Henry Brothers. That's my Hell Mountain source. And I have a vineyard here in St. Helena that's kind of adjacent to the Spotswood Winery. And I call that vineyard the Healy. Those three major vineyards that play this.
This wine's just okay. That's good. Yeah, that's good. Balanced.
Each AVA brings its own attribute to the blend.
I like the mouthfeel, and I love the just the nice tannins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good wine. It's a good blend. So I've been working with these vineyards for years and years and years.
So. Yeah. All right. So we do this section called Sip and Spit. And it's kind of more like sip, savor, and spit. So I don't want these damn long answers. You know, I've made people not answer stuff because they're scared to alienate and lose friends. Not like they have any. Kind of like myself and my four listeners. All right. So first question. Worst advice you were ever given?
Worst advice I was ever given. Oh, I got to think about these.
That's not that difficult. I mean, the advice, I'll give you one. One of my professors told me that I should give up my athletic scholarship. I should quit school and go home and live with my parents and work. And I look at him every day. I have a picture of Dr. David Solzman from the University of Illinois Chicago on my desk.
Boy, that's making me think. Worth advice.
This is supposed to be like a 1.5 minute round, and it's like on the average person. You know, I asked David.
Okay, the worst advice I've ever had.
This is like no podcast you've ever been on before.
Don't leave your schooling. Don't leave your college studies.
Okay.
Don't take off on. Don't finish your college studies.
Okay. Favorite vintage that you've ever produced? The one that you just kept coming back year after year?
1991 was a killer vintage.
Why?
Just everything about it was perfect. And it aged gracefully for 20 years.
The vintage that keeps giving you nightmares?
I struggled with 2012.
Really?
It was a great vintage. I was in a predicament where I was a little bit of a vagabond situation with my production. Mm-hmm. And I was having to move my wines a little too much in 12.
Okay. Favorite wines of yours not named or made by you? This is where you literally lose friendships.
I have a winemaker that I love trading every single year with. And I would say that's Ken Bernard. He owns Ancien Wines. He actually makes Pinot and Chardonnay.
Really? Wow. And the truth has come out, folks.
And that's a wine I just have to have every time.
Okay. Least favorite varietal?
To make wine, I love Zinfandel, but I have no desire to make it. I like drinking it.
Yeah, you know who I had this who I interviewed this morning was Robert Bialy.
Oh yeah,
he makes Zinfandel. The Black Chicken, and even the Royal Punisher.
Yeah,
the Petit Sirah, man. Whew.
I love drinking it. I just don't have no desire.
Yeah, well, I think I think the thing is, and it's his stick is like he's literally the only one that puts Zinfandel on the map in Napa. Okay, because I mean he makes like I think 8, 9, 10 different Zinfandels, and I kept asking him like honestly. Where is the Cabernet vineyard? He's like, there is not. I said, I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. because of the time change. And I'm going to find the damn Cabernet vine in your vineyard. He's like, you're not going to find it. I said, you want to meet me 4 a.m?
And his vineyards are in the middle of suburbia. Have you seen that?
I know.
Vineyards surrounded by.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. All right. Best non-traditional food and wine pairing.
Artichokes. I mean, here in California.
Asparagus you can't pair anything with. Sorry.
Well, because right here we have artichokes in our backyard.
Yeah.
But artichokes are tough.
So what would you pair with an artichoke?
I'd probably have to go the route of rosé, something, that carries really, really good acidity and has, good forward fruit.
What was the worst pairing you had to be a part of at a wine dinner? The one that you said, oh my God, this is going to be horrible.
This is my pet peeve.
This is what's going to get the listeners right here. Give it to me.
I make Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah.
And I am not the guy that says chocolate and Cabernet go together.
Did you talk to Kathy Corson on my drive up here? Because she said the same thing. I swear to God.
When I finish up a dinner, we're usually finishing up with something out of the
molten chocolate cake with berries and Cabernet.
Please, please, please let me finish my wine with cheese and then let's have the chocolate dessert with coffee.
Okay, there you go. You seem pretty opinionated about that. I don't blame you, though.
When I do want to make a dinner, I call ahead and try to make those arrangements.
Yeah. Why do you think that's such a common pairing?
Cabernet will go with chocolate as long as the chocolate is sort of less sweet, more bitter. You know, mm-hmm. It will hold up okay, but like you say, that chocolate mousse with the berries and the whipped cream and the caramel sauce, it just doesn't work. It's a train wreck.
Favorite sports team?
Grew up with the Denver Broncos.
Bad. John Elway, baby.
Yeah, I actually made wine for John Elway.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Seems like do you feel like every athlete tries to get in the wine game?
A lot.
A lot of them do.
Yeah.
Okay. One song that best describes you.
Oh, my Lord.
Mine would be Apple Bottom Jeans.
What is it? Leonard Skinner Running Fences? What is that?
I don't know. You're the wrong guy.
there's a song by Leonard Skinner about running fences. I don't know the title of it, but you know, being a farm kid, you know, out on my own, kind of renegade.
Awesome. One trait that no one knows about you, or one hobby even, trait or hobby.
Well, a lot of people know this about me. I love woodworking. My hobby is building, crafting stuff out of wood. But I love cooking. Cooking's becoming a big part of my life now.
Really?
I love being a dad.
Yeah.
Absolutely love being a dad.
That's pretty good, huh? And you're in the great years of I hate you, right? Or not really.
I have a great relationship with my daughter, Sophia.
That's what people say. You know, your daughter's great until she becomes a teenager. My daughter's 10 going on 11, and she is a lot like me. Like, I don't need to buy a gun. Because she has my mouth. So it's kind of, I feel good. Like my wife doesn't like my mouth, my sarcasm, but you know what, when you have a daughter, that's better than owning a gun, right? If she can use her mouth and thing. But, what's the future? What does the future hold for you?
Well, I tell you, the whole playing field is being reset with this pandemic.
Yeah.
But you know what? I look forward and I'm optimistic. I think for a brand like mine, the resetting of what's going to be happening out there, there's great opportunity. I think a lot of people are realizing that, you know, direct consumer shipping wine to your doorstep, shipping wine to you is a good thing. I see that as being a lot of potential for us. I think that, like we talked about, the relationships, we're going to be able to bond bigger and greater relationships and you know, do more of our business in commerce. You know, online, on phone, in person, hopefully soon.
Yeah, awesome.
I do see myself getting away from the big, ginormous three-tier concept. I kind of do.
So. Awesome. Thanks for your honesty. Thanks for you not knowing what song you'd be named. All we know is Leonard Skinner.
I know.
That's pretty bad. But thanks. I appreciate spending the time. And that was a very great conversation. I thank you for listening, Mike. Thanks for welcoming me in. And we're going to have a little bonus content for my Cork and Taylor supporters. So check that out on patreon.com, Cork and Taylor. I thank you. And let's keep uncorking the lighter side of wine.